supported by Bill Meeks at Meeks Mixed Media, maximizing brands large and small in the new media space. On the web at meeksmixedmedia.com. Also by Violet USA. Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia. On the web at violetusa.com. And by Telos Systems. Telos Audio and Networks, the best way to hear from there. On the web at telos-systems.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
Armstrong, jumped off of out of a building over his fights with Sarnoff at RCA over television.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And the Twirt Engineering Army is here. We're here to talk about frequency modulation.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome in. It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. So glad that you've joined us. And I'm here with our usual bevy of co-hosts. First of all, from the Hudson Valley in New York, it's Tom Ray. Hello, Tom.
Oh, hi, Kirk. How you doing?
Are you soldering?
I'm just playing with solder. I like playing with hot stuff. So,
it's funny you should be doing that, because for the first time in actually maybe a year or two, I was soldering today. I'm putting together a demo kit that we're going to do a video tomorrow showing how some Axia gear works. And I had to solder up a little thing to make an on-air light come on.
And let's see. He hadn't soldered in how long?
Couple of years. The soldering iron still worked, and the soldering iron, the solder itself had not expired yet.
That's a good thing. And how many cold solder joints did you make, and how many bad words?
I didn't have any cold solder joints. I did want to say a bad word or two. I got a little burn here to prove it.
You're not a veteran soldering person unless you have burns all over your place, just like a veteran RF person.
I used to be a veteran, but I retired from that. But it's a good practice to keep up with because soldering is an important skill. Let's check in with Chris Tobin, a man who I don't know if you've ever soldered a day in his life. Are you wearing a tux tonight? Oh, no, you're not.
No tux tonight, but I have soldered many a night, and I have a few scars to show it somewhere.
Is that a scar on your shoulder?
No, it's a crab. I'm fresh back from an outside broadcast in Aruba. Got back this morning.
Tell us about that in a nutshell. What happened in Aruba?
One of our FM stations, Fresh FM, did a 3-day broadcast from Aruba in Marriott, part of the tourism board's promotion. So we did a European ISDN connection, a couple of microphones, and broadcast on the beach. It was a very nice time. So
he's crabby because he's back in New York.
Yes.
It's a tough job, but sometimes the chief engineer's got to go do it.
That's right, exactly. They asked for volunteers. I raised my hand. Apparently nobody else did, so I went.
did you leave your wife at home?
She had the option to travel with me, but however, her freelance work required her staying at home, so no, she did not.
I'm sorry for
she
her.
Was
She's
on,
such a mess.
She was on the agenda. She was on the itinerary to come, but couldn't make it happen.
Oh, well. Speaking of itineraries, here's the guy that's always on the itinerary. It's Chris Tarr. Howdy, Chris.
Howdy. I was actually, I was soldering today for our AM radio station, the sports station. They dropped a couple of XLR to 1/8-inch jack adapters onto my desk going, thump, can you fix these? So I was actually in front of the soldering iron most of the afternoon fixing cables for them. So, you were in Aruba. I was sitting at my workbench soldering lots of connectors.
You mentioned XLR to 1/8-inch connector. I got to say, that's just wrong. That's just wrong.
the thing is, though, with today's digital recorders, most of them take some form of 1/8-inch input. So while I agree with you that that's just wrong, a lot of the equipment that you use now, the handheld digital recorders, use those 1/8-inch inputs on them.
Actually,
say that three times fast.
As wrong as it is, for my little Axia demo I'm doing tomorrow, I needed to get from the 1/8-inch output on the bottom of an iPod Touch into an XLR. And so,
you had to do just the opposite. I'm just going the other way.
Yeah. And
I could have built up a cable, sure, and, you know, burnt my hands even more. I ended up going through several different adapters to finally get from 1/8 inch to XLR. But then I was at here in Nashville. We have an outlet of a store that many of us know and love now that Radio Shack doesn't always carry what we need. We have a Guitar Center. And at Guitar Center, that's how we say it in the South, Guitar Center, they have cables that are 1/8 inch on one end, 1/8 inch stereo, tip ring sleeve, and on the other end, two XLRs. And they're very neatly made, and they look nice. Who'd have thunk?
Oh, I don't even bother soldering anymore with XLRs. I buy the Nutrik solderless type, and just today I made an 1/8 inch to XLR by clamping it on, and off I went. It was great. You know, the Nutrik, the little guys, the insertion displacement connectors. It's great.
Yeah, yeah.
No soldering involved.
Those do work well. They're pretty cool. I've gotten to use them only, I think, at the trade show when they said, here, try this out.
Yeah, I've used them for the last several years with much success. One of the Olympics I worked at, we did 250 connections with the XLRs, only had one bad connection.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
You did soldering. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, the year before that, we did soldering. It was like, no way.
Yeah. Hey, well, we want to jump into our show here. The show is part of our what we call our foundation series. And we had pretty good comments about the AM show we did a couple weeks ago about the fundamentals of AM modulation and amplification and transmission. Today, the subject is FM. FM modulation, FM amplification, and FM transmission, and maybe a little bit about reception as well. So during the AM show, we covered some fundamentals. Some fundamentals like what is RF, what's radio frequency, what's radio frequency energy, what's a radio wave, what's a carrier wave, and how can we convey information on that carrier wave? Well, all the things that we talked about, at least up to that point with AM, those also apply to FM. Now, if you're not an engineer and you're listening or two or watching the show, if you're not a technologist, then you may think that, well, let's see, between 88 and 108 on the dial, that's FM. Well, that's the frequency. It doesn't have to be frequency modulated. It doesn't have to be FM modulated. It could be amplitude modulated, like the band right above that on the dial. Well, actually not on your dial, but the band right above that, the aviation band, is amplitude modulated. So that's just some proof for you. You know, when pilots talk to each other or talk to the tower, they're not using FM radios like you might think, like, you know, police band cars or a lot of amateur radio operators in the 2-meter band. The pilots are actually talking on radios that are amplitude modulated. So frequency modulation doesn't necessarily apply to a particular frequency or frequency band. It's just a way of conveying information on that carrier wave that we talked about during the AM fundamental series. So let's kind of round robin here, just, but I'll take a moment to talk about my understanding of this, and then the other guys can give a little bit of theirs. We're just going to talk about the theory for a minute of conveying information on a carrier wave. With amplitude modulation, you may remember that to carry information, we have to do something to the carrier wave. We got to change it. We got to make it move somehow so that some information is conveyed upon it or by that movement. And with AM, we change its amplitude or the volume of that carrier wave. With FM, we're actually moving the frequency up and down, up and down, up and down. Now, with AM, the frequency stays the same, although we do create sidebands, and we create a stronger and louder and stronger and louder and stronger and louder amplitude of signal. With FM, the amplitude stays the same all the time, or at least that's the idea. And we move the frequency of this carrier back and forth, up and down the dial just a little bit. Now, if we did this too much, we'd interfere with other radio stations, other services. But with FM, we move this carrier wave just a little bit. And remember with the AM series, we talked about how we modulate the wave by changing the amplitude exactly in time with the audio that we're wanting to convey. Well, with FM, it's kind of the same thing, except we're changing the frequency. We're modulating or moving the frequency exactly in time with the audio. In fact, it's the audio signal that's coming into the modulator that's moving the FM carrier wave up and down and up and down in frequency. Now, there's different ways to accomplish this up and down and up and down in frequency. And Tom Ray, you've been around FM for a good long time. I'd like for you, surprise, to school us just a little bit on some of the on maybe the most common old school method for moving an FM carrier wave up and down in frequency with an incoming signal.
Well, one of the real old school method is a, and excuse my voice tonight, my allergies are acting up. The real old school method was a tube called a phasotron that used an actual magnet around the tube that varied the, I believe it was the capacitance of the tube that caused the frequency to shift. Nowadays, we use a varactor diode, which is it's a special diode that acts as a capacitor that changes the frequency of the oscillator, and it allows the frequency to slide back and forth at the audio rate. And it's the old phasotrons are actually kind of cool. Up at the Alpine Tower, which is the Armstrong's original tower in Alpine, New Jersey, they have an Armstrong Memorial transmitter that was built by Steve Hemphill from down in Philadelphia way. Transmitter, Kirk, is absolutely gorgeous. Runs at 250 watts on Armstrong's original frequency, which I believe was 41.8, and it uses a phasotron exciter. And the thing is just absolutely, you see this big black case in the middle of it, and in the middle of it's this phasotron tube that's about that big around, maybe 2 inches in diameter. And it just sounds fantastic. So that's how we, to my understanding, how we accomplish it these days with a regular old FM exciter.
We've got a link in the show notes to the Armstrong Tower site. We'll have that in the show notes. And I'm checking right now to see if the Twit Studios can put this link up, or can it's a Wikipedia page. So perhaps they could just bring that up and have a look at the tower. Tom, the Armstrong Tower is kind of unusual. It looks to me more like a tower that would be carrying high voltage transmission lines across country. What's the design of this Armstrong Tower?
Well, I think the design or the thinking behind it was, first of all, Armstrong was kind of a showman in his own way. Matter of fact, at the they have a little museum, the W2XMN building, which is Armstrong's original call sign, is still there. And they have a little museum set up, and they have pictures of him. They had this metal sphere on top of the tower, and they have pictures of him standing on it. No climbing belts, no nothing. I guess after a while, the insurance company said, enough. No more of this tower climbing. But he had originally, if you look at the screen, you see you have the cross arms there. They had antennas on each of the cross arms, and I'm assuming that there's probably some correlation in the length of those cross arms to some portion of a wavelength at around 41 megahertz, for phasing of the antenna. But he had antenna elements. Those cross arms supported the actual antennas on each side of the tower. And that's pretty much the impetus for the design. And that tower nowadays, it's ironic that after 9/11 in New York City, several TV stations put backups up there, in addition to several FM stations. So it's back being used as an FM tower. But it's very ironic that the TV stations are up there, because Armstrong, jumped off of out of a building over his fights with Sarnoff at RCA over television. And here the tower is being backups.
And that is no short tower. It's 425 feet tall, certainly a lot shorter than what broadcasters would like to be on to cover the New York City metropolitan area. But after 9/11,
It's on top of the Palisades there, which is one of the highest places around New York City. And let me tell you, if you've never seen this tower up close, if you're on an Amtrak train coming down the Hudson River, or even if you're just driving across the George Washington Bridge, and if you're driving towards Jersey, if you look to the right, you can't miss this tower. It is massive if you're standing next to it. I mean, you just sit there and look up and go, oh, my Lord. it just says FM, and it just says radio. It's a very very cool thing to see.
Yeah. All right. So the phasotron tube was one way to create FM. Now there have been plenty of solid state circuits as well, mostly in popularity throughout the 70s and the 80s and most of the 90s actually. And then the solid state circuits were usually based on a fairly loose oscillator that had a varactor diode in it. Chris Tobin, can you speak at all to the how a varactor diode works? Sorry to surprise you like this.
The varactor diode, using the capacitance in the diode and the voltage variation, creates the oscillations you need for the frequency. In the shortest terms, I guess that's the best way to put it.
So the varactor is like a variable capacitor, and the capacitance of the varactor diode can move instantaneously, and it's affected by the signal, the voltage that's being fed to it. So we can take the audio signal and apply this to the varactor diode circuit and thereby change its capacitance and thereby change the frequency at which this oscillator runs.
Right.
I should point out, and maybe Chris Tarr can help me talk about this a bit. In most FM exciters, and in the broadcast business, it is the FM exciter that generates the carrier frequencies. Let's imagine it's 98.1. That's right in the middle of the FM dial. So let's say we have a radio station that's on 98.1. Well, the FM exciter is what's going to generate the signal that's on 98.1. And this FM exciter is also the device that's going to take the audio signal coming into it, which, by the way, we'll get into more of that later when we talk about stereo. But for now, let's just think about mono audio coming into this exciter. And it's the exciter that couples this audio and to the oscillator and makes the oscillator move up and down and up and down in frequency at the audio rate. Chris, what can you add to how that occurs and what else happens inside the exciter?
Wow. Well, there's several ways, depending on the model of the exciter, how that works. Harris has their digit exciter, which does it digitally. I think Nautel has a couple that do that as well. But essentially, what you're doing with the exciter is you're taking either the composite, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, the composite signal coming from your audio processor that has the stereo information and the subcarriers and things like that. But it takes that signal, applies that with the modulator, which is either, all new transmitters now are synthesized for frequency. That usually goes through a couple of stages of amplification. And if you look at the building blocks of the FM transmitter, you start out with a very weak signal coming out of the transmitter, usually a couple of watts out of the exciter, then into some sort of intermediate power amplifier, which raises it to a couple hundred watts, which gives enough drive for the final amplification on the transmitter, which can be thousands of watts. So what that exciter does is it just takes the multiplex signal and then it joins that with the modulator on the exciter on frequency on 98.1, then amplifies it. It's actually the exciter is just essentially a low power transmitter.
Yep, sure is. You mentioned some different ways of coming up with the modulated signal. You mentioned Harris and Nautel, and I think actually several other companies like BE. Continental also make digital exciters. When we say digital, I've started hearing about this idea about 15 years ago. The idea of a digital FM exciter is that inside the exciter, instead of analog circuits that are pushed and pulled in their characteristics to push and pull the frequency up and down, a digital exciter is, at its heart, is a numerically controlled oscillator, or NCO. And an NCO is this really cool device. It's done in DSP, and we can generate a signal on, let's say, 98.1, and then we can take the audio data that's coming in and digitize that and take those numbers and, math, algorithm those against the oscillator and create a perfect, absolutely perfect modulation. One of the problems with any analog modulator, whether it's a tube type or solid state with transistors and varactor diodes and things such as that, is there are always going to be errors in that process. And I'll describe one of the errors that's always been a little tough to deal with and has affected the way FM has sounded, actually, until we got to the point of numerically controlled oscillators. And that has to do with the PLL, or phase lock loop, part of the circuit. We have this signal, again, let's say example 98.1, and we want to move the signal up and down, up and down, up and down, and modulate it with the incoming audio. Well, but it's got to average 98.1. So there's got to be a circuit in there somewhere that watches this over time and makes sure that the signal averages 98.1. If it's allowed to just free run and drift, it may drift all around the dial. It may end up at 98.15 or 98.2. And, then the people at 98.3 won't be very happy about that. So it's important to keep this thing overall on the right frequency on an average. How do we do that? Well, we have a circuit that monitors this, and we develop typically an error voltage between an oscillator that's crystal controlled in the exciter and the free-running oscillator that's being modulated. And then this error voltage is used to also apply back to the free-running oscillator to hold it within the right range, to hold it close to or on 98.1 overall. This does bring up a problem, though, because when we correct the free-running oscillator, if we correct it too fast, we end up actually distorting the audio that is modulating it. In other words, if we have a big bass, you know, a big bass guitar, or a big thud, thud, thud that has come along. And in the past 15, 20 years, we've had more of that kind of music that has a lot of big bass excursions in the audio. Well, that starts to confuse the phase lock loop circuit to thinking, oh, what are you doing way over here? I got to bring you back to 98.1. Well, if we do that, we're artificially bringing it back to 98.1, and we're destroying the original, you know, the audio that was modulating that.
Well, exciters back, the early PLL exciters, when the rhythmic music you were just talking about came about, I remember having a couple of exciters. The PLL would just unlock on heavy bass notes, and the exciter output would mute.
The Harris MS-15 was notorious for that.
There you go.
That's the one I was thinking of. RCAs.
Yep.
That's exactly right. And that was a problem with what we usually called single speed PLLs. Again, PLL stands for phase lock loop. And that's a way of keeping a circuit locked to something else over time as an average. So the exciter manufacturers recognized that audio processing was becoming more aggressive, that bass excursions were going to be stronger, that there was going to be faster, what you might call slewing of the modulating signal. And the exciter manufacturers had to respond to that because we were getting what can be called, I believe it can be called, slew rate distortion. The input signal wanted to do this real fast to give a big bass excursion. And the exciter said, we don't want to do that fast. That might be a problem. We might be going up or down the dial too far. And so the exciter phase lock loop would bring it back. So we ended up having to have a two-speed PLL. When you turn the exciter on, we'd have a PLL that would help the exciter find its proper frequency, and then it would switch to perhaps a slower PLL that would kind of watch things overall, and maybe two PLLs watching it, a faster one and a slower one. The faster one could be ignored for a while. The idea there to allow these big bass excursions. So a lot of the FM exciters that were designed and built throughout the late 1980s and through the 1990s were designed with this in mind to give us some cleaner audio. There's also a subject of what you might call pre-distortion. And I remember, I'm sure perhaps other companies did this first, but I remember reading a manual for a broadcast electronics exciter where they really talked about pre-distortion. Because the varactor diode, as interesting as it is not entirely a linear device, or it's not linear over a range that's broad enough for our purposes in making a voltage controlled oscillator. You know, that's a good term. We hadn't brought that up yet. A VCO is a good name for the oscillator that's inside an FM exciter, a voltage controlled oscillator, and it's controlled by two voltages: the incoming audio and the correction voltage. Correction voltage hopefully being slow, and the incoming audio being, you know, the incoming audio. So BE had this idea. Again, I don't know if they were the first, but to have a pre-distortion network to try to pre-distort the audio on a complementary basis to the characteristics of the varactor diode circuit. Does anybody have any experience about reading about this or experiencing an exciter that had this, and did it sound better?
I used the Continental 802As, I guess they were. They had pre-distortion in them, and it worked well. I mean, it did work very well. If you did a proof on it, you could see where it would fall apart depending on how hard you drove it. But at one point in the 80s, QEI came out with direct FM, where you didn't need distortion, pre-distortion, and they modulated the circuit directly from the audio, requiring very super linear circuits, so that the phase and, you know, the waveform was very straight, very, you know, very little skewing. But the pre-distortion on most of the good exciters, like Continental, I think BE, worked very well. You had a tough time knowing there was any issue there. Yeah. Given the processing of the day.
Well, if we're talking about modulating the FM carrier with just audio, just say mono audio, a mono audio signal, that's actually not so very difficult to do. We're just talking about going up to 15 or 20 kilohertz of audio. We're just talking about the audio spectrum from, you know, 20 hertz to 15 or 20 kilohertz. We tend to knock it off about 15 or 18 kilohertz to make room for something else called the stereo pilot. And I guess we'll spend just another minute on the FM modulator, but then I want to get into why the modulator has to be so good, because when you start transmitting stereo, the picture changes quite a bit. We have to be a lot more accurate about it. So we had circuits throughout the 80s and 90s that would try to create a much lower distortion on the modulated oscillator, so that what was being transmitted, this frequency modulated signal, would match very, very closely distortion down in the 0.05 or 0.007, 0.008% range of distortion in making this this FM signal, which was actually pretty good. Noise was a problem because these circuits were a little bit microphonic. You could tap on an FM exciter, a lot of them, and hear that tapping on the air. You guys ever experienced that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, what's a lot of fun is to go up and yell at it and hear yourself on the air.
most exciters, if you look inside, are, you know, most of their stuff is mounted on rubber bushings for isolation.
Yep. That's true.
Exactly. And since a Varicta diode uses capacitance, you definitely want to isolate that from the chassis.
There was an exciter made by CCA back when it was in Cherry Hill, I believe. CCA had an exciter that the entire board was mounted on these big long springs, and if you hit the exciter, you would hear on the air because it was
just like a big reverb unit.
That's awesome.
Well, I got to tell you, almost all these problems went away when they came up with the numerically controlled oscillator. And the NCO fixed a bunch of these problems. Now, when the manufacturer of the exciter designs a numerically controlled oscillator, he's got a whole bunch more things he's got to worry about, like the algorithms that are going to take the incoming audio, or in this case, a stereo baseband or AES audio with an internal stereo generator, and modulate this onto a signal. So there's still some magic, there's still some finesse involved in getting this done. But Harris was a real pioneer in that, and then I believe Nautel came out with an NCO, and then a few years later, virtually everybody has that except some of the less expensive designs. But nowadays, when we feed audio into an FM exciter, what we get out in terms of a frequency modulated signal is just darn near perfect compared to what came into it. Everybody experienced that? That accurate statement?
Yep. Yes, that would be accurate. Yep. Yeah,
I would think so.
Well, good. Thanks for the agreement. All right, I want to direct our attention to a web page, and you know what? I don't think I sent this yet over to Eric in Master Control. So let me send this over to Eric real fast. I want to point out a web page about the FM stereo and how that works. And you know, nothing says so much as a graphic. And Eric, if you scroll about halfway down that, there's a graphic on the right hand side that is just terrific. And if you can zoom that up. Of course, we'll have this link in the show notes. If you're listening to this podcast on audio, you can catch it there, and you can bring this web page up and have a look at it as well. So let's see. You know what? I didn't send it to Eric. How about we try that again? Da, 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 da. There you go, Eric. There's your link. The when it came time to do FM stereo in this country, the FCC had a mandate, and that is that stereo had to be compatible with mono FM radios. Tom, seems like you were telling me before the show that you know a little bit of history about this particular subject.
Well, our station in Hartford, Connecticut, WDRC-FM, is arguably the first commercial FM station in the world, starting its life out as in 1936 as W1XSL, which was an apex high-frequency station, which was AM on 40.3 megahertz. In 1939, it became W1XPW and part of the Yankee network with Armstrong, and became a commercial FM station. And we've been doing, we've been doing FM ever since. But there's a long story where we sold the station and then said, "Uh-oh," and put the station back on the air. But with FM stereo, back in, I'm going to say the late 60s, probably 67 to 69, is when you started seeing the FM stereo stations come on the air. And it had been experimented with before that, of course. But the way it's generated is quite interesting, because especially with the older units that used to drift, because you'd get all kinds of weird distortions in the stereo and in the high frequencies. But you've got, you start out, you take your left channel and your right channel, you combine it to get your mono signal, which modulates the transmitter from 0 to 15 kilohertz. There's a guard band of about 4 kilohertz. You have the stereo pilot at 19. And then we have the stereo information where we take the left and right and subtract them and come up with a stereo difference signal. And the interesting thing is that it is centered on 38 kilohertz, and it's a double sideband, single sideband signal with no carrier, no AM carrier. It's an AM signal to create the stereo difference.
Eric has brought this up, and Eric, if you want to zoom in even further on just the left-hand part of that graphic, I'm sorry, but the lines that are drawn there are pretty slim, and they're a little bit hard to see on Skype anyway. Maybe they look better at your end. But Tom, you can see it now too. Indeed, the way stereo is transmitted is compatible with the way mono is transmitted. So if you have a mono radio, you're not hearing just the left channel or just the right channel of the stereo transmission. You are hearing the left and the right combined into one. So if they're playing a Beatles song on your oldie station, and you know the John, Paul, George, and Ringo are on one side, and the instruments are all on the other side, which was a big mistake how that happened, you'll hear the singers, the Beatles, and you'll hear the instruments all together on your FM mono radio, your clock radio, or whatever you may have. But we had to have we wanted to figure out a way to figure out how to transmit stereo so it was compatible. So, Tom, you started describing that. If you don't mind, I'll pick up where you left off.
You do is you take. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you said you were going to go.
That's okay. I've just done this 1,000 times, so I'm kind of used to describing it. Tell you what, I'll describe it, and then you fix where I mess up. Okay.
Works for me.
The way we do this is inside this device called a stereo generator, and nowadays most FM processors have a stereo generator in them, and also nowadays most FM exciters also have a stereo generator. You can use either one depending on how you get the audio to the FM exciter. So it doesn't matter which way it happens, but here's what happens. Left and right signals are combined together. We put a plus sign between them. We algebraically sum them together, and we get the signal known as left plus right. And if you look at that graphic, on the left-hand side of that, you'll see from 30 hertz to about 15 kilohertz, we have mono audio, left plus right. And that's the result of taking L plus R. That's the mathematic combination of the left and the right signal. Then, inside the stereo generator, we do something kind of interesting. We also come up with a signal that's the left minus the right. So we take the whatever audio is in the left channel, and we algebraically, instantaneously subtract the audio that's in the right channel. Now, what's left over from that may not necessarily be intelligible, but it will be the instantaneous difference between the left and the right channels. So if you had somebody speaking, let's say, only on the left channel, well, the left plus right is the same as the left, because right would be zero in that case. And left minus right would also be the same thing. You would also have the speaker's voice in the left minus right. So in the case of left only or right only audio, left plus right basically equals left minus right. There may be an inversion sign in there, a polarity sign different, but the audio will be the same. If you have mono audio, let's say you have a person talking and is equally in both channels, the left channel and the right channel. When you combine that, left plus right, well, that gives you all the audio. Left minus right, if they're perfectly balanced, equals zero. There's nothing in the left minus right because the left equals the right, so left minus right equals zero. So we transmit this left plus right. We also transmit the left minus right. And the way we do that is a little bit interesting. We wanted to come up with a way, we wanted to come up with a way to indicate to FM receivers that, hey, this station is transmitting a stereo signal. You should turn on your stereo circuits if you have them. And it was decided to do that with a 19 kilohertz pilot tone. If you could hear this, and I guess some people can, you could hear this. It's just a tone at 19 kilohertz. Well, the circuit that generates this 19 kilohertz carrier also is responsible for generating the 38 kilohertz, which is what the left minus right is modulated upon. Now, remember, 2 weeks ago, we talked about AM modulation, amplitude modulation. Well, that's what's going on with the left minus right. We take the left minus right signal. Remember, it may not be intelligible audio, but it's usually some audio there. And we modulate that onto 38 kilohertz, and then we suppress that carrier. Anybody know why that was developed, why we decided they decided to suppress the 38 kilohertz subcarrier?
I would guess that it was probably something to do with the fact that the 38 kilohertz technically is unnecessary. It's necessary to take the left minus right at the receive end. But my guess is that it would just take up more space and more modulation space on the FM signal. So that's my guess.
Okay. That's always been my guess, too. I really don't know. Maybe an expert
can tell. I could never find in any history why that was chosen. It was just, it's almost as if out of thin air back in the 1950s, they decided, well, audio ends at 15 kilohertz. What's the next logical thing? Maybe a multiple of something. That's how it came to be. I haven't been able to find anything that really definitively says why.
Well, obviously, we use the 19 kilohertz pilot. We use that to regenerate the 38 kilohertz. So inside your radio, inside your stereo radio, it's picking up that 19 kilohertz pilot. And then there's a circuit that doubles that and makes 38 kilohertz. And that's reinserted into the whole signal there with the sidebands. And then that's sent to a demodulator that demodulates the entire left minus right part. So let me continue on with the explanation here. We remember we have the left plus right, the stereo pilot, and we have the left minus right transmitted in kind of an odd way. It's AM, which is riding on the FM at 38 kilohertz, and the subcarrier at 38 is removed. So we have a dual sideband suppressed carrier signal at 38 kilohertz. In the radio picks up the 19 kilohertz pilot, says, oh, I got a stereo signal here. It doubles the 19 kilohertz pilot internally, which is not hard to do. And then it adds that to the L minus R signal, and it demodulates that. So it also, your radio also runs the whole baseband signal through a low-pass filter and demodulates the left plus right with an FM discriminator. Demodulate this whole thing with an FM discriminator, and then it demodulates the L minus R. Sorry to get that backwards. But what you end up with inside the FM radio is you end up with an L plus R signal and an L minus R signal, which is exactly what you had back inside the stereo generator when you had the L plus R and the L minus R. We call that matrixing. Inside the FM stereo receiver, we do the opposite. We dematrix this. So we have the L plus R, we have the L minus R. Let's do some math. L plus R plus L minus R equals 2L, or the left channel. And if we take L plus R minus L minus R, then we have minus 2R, or we have the minus right channel. We can invert that and have the right channel. So using this L plus R and the L minus R, we're able to, in the receiver, with ordinary dumb analog circuits, which is now done digitally, we can derive the left channel, and we can derive the right channel. And then we send those through the volume control to the amplifier and out to the speakers. And that
right, for everybody on chat, we're going to be doing a test after we're done with the show here. So hopefully you're all taking notes on how this all works.
Mr. Tarr, did you get all that yourself?
I'm sorry, I fell asleep there for a second. Yeah, I got it. Got it.
Yeah, was the chat room really crickets? Is that what you're trying to say?
I think right now the collective eyes are starting to gloss over.
Well, the point is, at the studio, we started with left and right. We transmit a compatible left plus right for mono radios and a left minus right, which contains the difference information. And then the stereo radio picks all that up and turns it back into left and right. Now, a terrible, terrible thing happens if the engineer at the station or the recording engineer who makes a record makes a mistake and inverts the phase of one of the channels. Then, inside the radio station, we have left and minus right, or maybe we have minus left and right. And the whole process I described completely falls apart and gets screwed up if there's a wiring mistake like that. So it's a really good idea to keep every bit of audio throughout a radio studio, throughout a recording studio, to keep all this in phase. By the way, we call that relative phase, relative the left relative to the right, or the right relative to the left. In recording studios, someday we'll talk about this, they also worry about absolute phase, which is, you know, the breath coming out of your mouth, making the speaker cone come towards your ear, making sure all that happens correctly. So guys, we've gone through the stereo. Huh? What's that?
I was going to say, one of the interesting side effects of the phase, however, that a lot of people used to do in the olden days is for karaoke. You could invert one of the channels and all of a sudden the vocals or anything mono disappears, which happens on the air a lot, too, if you have something wrong in your plant. One of the, you know, if you have the phasing correct, one of the unintended consequences is no one can hear you.
That's right. Nobody can hear the announcers for sure. Basically, if the phase is incorrect and you listen on a mono radio, you have just made yourself hear actually the left minus the right if one of the sides is out of phase with the other. And so anything that's mono, anything that's common to the two channels disappears. Now, this is used for positive effect. You know, in the backs of magazines, sometimes they advertise, remove vocals from records, sing along with the records. That's what they're doing. They're inverting the phase, mixing them together, getting rid of anything that's mono, which also is usually the drums. You're usually minus the drums, minus a lot of bass, and minus the singers. Sometimes reverb is done in kind of a stereo way, so there's some shimmeriness of what used to be voices still in the recording. These boxes also tend to be able to then add in some bass, whatever's left, to try to make it sound a bit more natural. And then some of them even give you an output that has some pseudo stereo in it, so it kind of sounds like it's back into stereo, when in fact they had to reduce it to mono to get rid of the singer voice. But I digress.
There's actually a story about a radio station that in their legal ID wanted to bury their actual city of license and, you know, of course, of the second city. So what they did is they recorded the actual city of license in with the phase cancellation in it. They purposely reversed the phase of that. So when you heard it on the radio, you'd hear the call letters, and just buried in the background out of phase was the actual city of license. And then it would come back with the big voice with the city that they wanted to get in. So apparently the FCC didn't think that was all that funny. They thought, you know, A for creativity and F on, you know, legal obligations.
Oh my goodness. There was a joke that ran around the internet circles for a while in with radio engineers, and it was the callers are saying, what's the time station in Boulder, Colorado?
WWV.
WWV, that's right. So somebody did a legal ID for WWV. It was all time, all the time, WWV, Fort Collins, Denver.
You give us 20 minutes, we'll give you 20 minutes.
That's right. Oh, all right. So we've confused everybody with all this L plus R, L minus R. I've described the stereo generator process. There's a Wikipedia article about that. There's other things that can go in the stereo baseband. Let's take a look at that graphic one more time, Eric. And in that graphic, you'll see some things that are higher up in the frequencies. There's a little thing called RBDS, Radio Broadcast Data Service. That's at 57 kilohertz, which just happens to be 19 kilohertz times 3. That's how we come up with that. We can transmit little bits of data there, some slow text for artist and title. So if you have a more modern radio that has RBDS, often called RDS, which is what they call it in the rest of the world, outside of America, you can see title and artist and the station call letter information. That can all be transmitted right there. Then there's also room for what we would call some subcarriers. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the direct band that they're showing on this graphic. You want to describe
direct
that?
Direct band was MSN's thing. They've actually canceled it now. Smart watches and their smart devices. They would transmit data in that subcarrier range in different markets. And I think, I believe it is a year from this past January. I think it's January 2011 or 2012 that they're actually turning that off.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, but you have a little wristwatch and subscribe to it and get the weather and sports scores and stock market
quotes.
Yeah,
the watch basically just heard the subcarrier, you know, picked up the subcarrier over the air. And that had data encoded in it. And the watch would show you, you know, the weather and text messages and things like that.
So these subcarriers, there's some room up there that the FCC has allowed broadcasters to transmit some additional information. Years ago, this is how Muzak was transmitted to stores. An FM radio station would have some Muzak reels of tape, or they'd have a satellite receiver that picked up Muzak back before satellite receivers were actually pretty cheap to deploy to stores. And the radio station would put the Muzak audio on one of these subcarriers, usually at 67 kilohertz or at 92 kilohertz. I get those numbers right, guys?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, okay. And these were typically frequency modulated in those little areas up there, I believe.
They're frequency modulated, yes.
And oftentimes a reading for the blind service would go in this area. So you could buy a radio that could pick up subcarriers. Sometimes these were fixed tuned, and sometimes these were available through government programs to blind folks. They could tune this in and listen to a reading for the blind services. Also in big cities, New York City, L.A., Chicago, a lot of times – various ethnic organizations would rent time on these subcarriers because, hey, the coverage of the subcarrier is almost as much as the coverage of the radio station. And although the audio was not great quality, it was adequate for voice and a little bit of music. It was sort of like AM quality. Ethnic groups could reach a large population of people who wanted to subscribe or listen to the audio that's available on these services. Sometimes these were considered private services. Sometimes they're considered open to the public.
I can mention something too.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, with the subcarriers, the other thing to keep in mind, you'll see some numbers there on that graph. That's the injection level or the amount of that modulation that you're going to inject into the baseband. You see 10%, 10%, 5%. Keep in mind, and for those of you who are, you know, just getting into engineering or are interested about that, that is additive with your total modulation. So, for example, for an FM radio station, the FCC says you can have 100% modulation. Well, that 100% is your audio plus the stereo pilot, which is 9%. So you have, you know, essentially, you know, that 100% creates that. Now, let's say you add 5% for RBDS. Well, you have to take away 5% from your total modulation. Well, the FCC's ruled you can get half of that back. So, for example, you have 100% modulation. You decide to turn on the 5% for RDS. Well, now you're at 105%, so you've got to bring your entire modulation back down to 100. Well, the FCC has said, well, we'll give you back, you know, you can have 2.5% of that back. So, for example, if you start adding different carriers, for example, if you have that direct band 10%, and RBDS at 5, that's 15%, which means your audio baseband is down, you know, below 90% with that. So, you know, you get a little bit of that back. But that's one of the downsides of adding these subcarriers is if you're in a competitive market where audio is everything and you need to be louder than the next guy, you lose a little bit of audio modulation by adding these subcarriers into your signal.
You're exactly right.
So just get a composite clip or you'll be fine.
Or generate square waves. That's all you need to do.
You know, or call your close personal friend Frank Footy.
That could be a whole show right there. It's a composite clipper. Oh my goodness. So the whole signal that Eric's been showing you on the graphic there, that if you're listening, you can go to the Wikipedia article about FM baseband. That is the signal that comes out of a stereo generator. And that is the signal, the baseband, sometimes we call it the multiplex or the mux signal, that goes into the modulator of an FM exciter. All that information, which is from zero up to just under 100 kilohertz, goes in. Now, earlier we were talking about why an FM modulator needs to be very linear and very accurate. Because from, you know, just to transmit a little bit of audio, that's not such a high hurdle. But to be linear and phase accurate and have the frequency response to be accurate across that whole band of 30 hertz up to almost 100 kilohertz, that's a trick. That takes some of the best, took some of the best analog design available to make that happen. To make that entire baseband signal modulate correctly and accurately and everything stay in phase. If we think about just that stereo signal, that left minus right part goes is centered at 38 kilohertz. And on the low end, it goes down to what, about 23 kilohertz? And at the, I mean, I'm sorry, 25 kilohertz. At the high end, it goes to 53 kilohertz. So that's from 30 hertz to 53 kilohertz. All that information, the left plus right, left minus right, that's got to be in excellent phase coherence across that. So we can't have any part of the circuit that says, well, I don't really feel like acting this fast on this 53 kilohertz signal. I think I'll be a little slow on that. We can't do that. It's got to be very, very accurate. There's some a couple of articles by a guy in our industry named Jeff Mendenhall. He used to work for BE, I believe works for Harris now. And I'd love to see if I can find some of the articles that Jeff Mendenhall has written on the fragility of the FM baseband signal and how we need to make sure as engineers that we treat it very, very well and keep it as clean as possible until it gets out the antenna. So, guys, we really ought to move on and talk about FM amplification. We got to get the signal out of the transmitter still. FM exciters on the market typically put out anywhere from 10 watts to 30 watts to 100 watts. We're getting more and more exciters that are really now little transmitters that put out 200-300 watts or so. But the idea is put out enough power to drive the next stage in the transmitter. And transmitter designs have changed a lot over the years. We used to have a lot of transmitters that maybe had an IPA, an intermediate power amplifier. This was typically a small tube, maybe capable of putting out 250 watts or maybe 500 watts. And then that tube output would drive a bigger tube that would typically give you 5, 10, 20 kilowatts of FM power. Who wants to tackle this a little bit, talk about Class C amplification and how this is typically accomplished?
Ooh, Class C.
Yeah. You know, in AM, we were talking about all the Class A and the Class AB amplifiers that had to be involved to keep the signal all nice and pure. One of the nice things with FM is we can be kind of ratty about how we amplify this thing. We can utilize a Class C amplifier, which is nice and efficient. We can use a tube or solid-state circuits to do this, and we can get a lot better efficiency out of a Class C amplifier than we can with a Class A or Class AB. And because the signal does not have to be the FM signal at 98.1 or wherever it may be, doesn't have to be linear in terms of amplitude. It just has to be flat in terms of its wherever it's going to be modulating across the dial for its modulation width. That's where the tube has to operate.
Class C's are nice and efficient, but their drawback, well, I shouldn't say drawback, but their output is rich in harmonics. So you have a great Class C amplifier, you better have a good low pass filter after that, or a band pass filter.
And they do.
Many things.
They do, yes. Because, you know, Class C amplifiers typically operate in a cavity. Like there's right. Most common in our industry is a quarter wave cavity, where this is a box that the tube sits in. That the box, the shape and the size of the box determines the frequency that things are going to operate on. And a lot of these boxes have a big sliding assembly that you can change actually the size of the box. And one company makes boxes that are a half wave long, and this lets them do some interesting things with how they feed the high voltage to the tube. I know we're hearkening to the tube days right now, and there are plenty of transmitters on the market now that are completely solid state. They don't have a tube in them, but I think most of us are very familiar with tube circuits.
Well, it's good to understand that the cavity size, you know, the size of the cavity, the circulating currents inside of it dictate how it performs. And I think Harris uses the shelf. BE made a unit that had a bellows above the PA cavity. So when you tuned it, the bellows would expand or contract, which would electrically change the cavity itself.
Yeah.
And in today's broadband solid state, I'll call it, or, you know, a fully non-tube transmitters, their outputs are just broadband. So there's no tuning required, so to speak. So you just have a filter that keeps things in check, and that's it. It couldn't be any easier. But there's still a lot of tubes out there. You know, a lot of places the tubes work very well.
Yep.
Oh, especially at high power, and especially at Class C, because you've got that efficiency. The only caveat is you want to make sure you've got all your parameters, your screen voltage, and everything correct, because you can affect the bandwidth of that cavity. And if you affect the bandwidth, you can start affecting your stereo separation. If you're running subcarriers, you can get the main audio mixing into the subcarrier audio, and which is not very nice. But we were talking about the Class C amplifier. The premise on the Class C, for those who don't know, is that the amplifier itself runs a cutoff. So if there's no signal, there's nothing. The amplifier is not, the tube is not conducting. What you're doing is, it's technically you're almost pulsing this thing, where it's only conducting on part of the incoming waveform. And when it hits the tuning stage, that's when you get that nice big pretty sine wave with all the attached harmonics, and that's where you get your efficiency from.
So I like to think of this as if you imagine taking your bicycle, turning it upside down, and start spinning one of the wheels on the bicycle, say the front wheel, mm-hmm. you can give it a little bit of power, push, 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 and the bicycle wheel will keep spinning. And that is what a Class C amplifier is. You give it little pulses of power, and it continues to run. Of course, it's doing this very fast, like 98.1 million times a second. So Class C amplifiers, we were talking about quarter wave and half wave size cavities. And to me, part of the magic of a Class C amplifier with a tube is that we can have this circuit that really is without the cavity, without the tuned circuit around the tube, which is a physical thing. We'd really have kind of a nasty amplifier. It would make all kinds of harmonics because it's switching, you know, millions of times per second on and off, on and off, on and off, making a lot of harmonics. But because the tube is sitting in a cavity which only wants to resonate at one frequency, well, and some harmonics, this makes the amplifier work much, much more nicely. And then after we extract the power from this cavity, from this tube cavity, with usually some kind of a loading control, some kind of a physical paddle that loads the circuit to the output of the circuit. We can then go through a low pass filter. So that is a physical design piece of metal with a different shape of parts to it that will basically eliminate any harmonics that are above the FM band. So if you're transmitting at 98.1 megahertz, the tube cavity is also making some signal at double that, which is what, 196.2 megahertz? Did I get that right? I think so.
Yeah, you went up in the TV channels.
Yep. Well, up in the TV channels. And we've got to knock those way, way, way down. So almost any transmitter on the market is going to have a low-pass filter. These vary a lot in designs. Mr. Tarr, I'm sure you've seen a couple of low-pass filters in your days. What can you describe a couple of them for us?
Oh, more than one. They generally, the ones I've worked with, BE and Harris, they have them coming right out of the top, and they almost look like a piece of transmission line, except that there's a couple of different designs, but essentially it almost like a bazooka, where it starts out with a you know, regular size transmission line on the end, and it gets bigger and then comes back down. And in fact, I have one transmitter site in Madison, Wisconsin, where we were just able to, with the transmitter in there, fit the low pass filter in there and wedge it so that as the door closes, it just almost touches the end of the tuning segment of the filter. So it filled the entire room. It was so large. So there's those designs, and there are other designs that are a little more compact that they're kind of interesting looking. They almost look like almost like chimes. You know, the transmission line goes across and you have different size segments coming out of it. So there's a couple different designs for that.
Yeah, in fact, the big one you're talking about is a very common bit. I always think of it as a bit of an old-fashioned design, but it works very, very well. One of the things that a low-pass filter has to do is, you know, it's shunting some amount of energy at these harmonic frequencies, times two, times three, times four, times five of the original signal. And in doing so, it's going to generate some heat, because it's got to get rid of this energy somehow, and this energy just doesn't like to pass through this this low-pass filter. You can think of a low-pass filter as like a treble control on your stereo, except instead of turning down high-frequency audio, it's turning down higher-frequency RF than what you're interested in to keep it from getting out to the antenna. And so the bigger ones of these naturally don't get very warm because they're big. They have a lot of metal there and a lot of physical area. And some of them are long. They can be 6-7 feet long, and they usually are, you know, plumbed overhead in the transmitter building. Some transmitter companies have decided to put the low pass filter inside the transmitter. And Continental is a company that's far as I know, always done this. All the ones I can think of have. It's a box a little bit bigger than a shoebox. And some of them get pretty hot, so I believe some of them even have forced air going through the low-pass filter to dissipate some of the heat from that. Seems like we had a Sparta FM transmitter at one station I worked at, and it also had a shoebox size. It was external, but a shoebox size low-pass filter, and it got hot. In fact, it blew up one. Yeah. Mr. Tobin, you take care of a few FM transmitters. What have you seen low-pass filters?
We have the Harris. The low-pass filter's on the outside, and thank goodness we have enough real estate in the room to mount them above the transmitter and not get into trouble. But they can get kind of warm when you're not tuned properly. The tube guys do well. But now we're moving into the solid-state realm, and most of the tuning, the filtering is done internally.
Really? Now, I haven't played with too many solid-state transmitters, so that's what you're seeing, is that the filtering is internal.
Yeah, you can do it internal. Yeah. So,
Tom,
very broad band though.
Yeah.
Very broad band.
Tom, what's your experience with these low pass filters?
Pretty much the same as Chris's. You know, the majority of the transmitters I've had, you know, through my career have been Harris. You have the big, I call it the sewer pipe hanging from the ceiling. There's the Continental, which has it inside, and they do run very warm, but newer transmitters, the solid state ones, because they're broadband, and because they also don't operate Class C, they're operating a different class. The low pass filter is fairly small, and it fits in the box, and you just kind of don't even think about it after a while. It's just kind of there.
So here's a pop up quiz for everybody: what device is at the end of the low-pass filter? In other words, after the energy has gone through the low-pass filter, what do we find?
directional watt meter.
Tom got it. I think there's some ducking going. I think when Tom talks, it knocks Chris Tobin down. I'm sorry, Chris. You have to be faster. Okay.
Sorry, Chris.
Actually, I have looked at some transmitters that had the directional coupler before the filtering.
And isn't that crazy? Because then you're going to be measuring harmonics as well as the main signal.
Yeah, I've actually seen that. I'm not sure if that was a mistake by the installer, the installation, or...
Yeah, I've seen a couple like that. I had McMartin that was the same way. They had the slug before it went into the filter, yeah.
Yeah, I never could figure that out.
McMartin is one of them. That's right.
I certainly have been to a transmitter site where the low-pass filter was installed backwards.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
I've seen that more than once, too, actually.
So what Tom had the answer. What's at the end of the low-pass filter? It's a directional coupler. This is where there's a sample of the energy flowing past that point is taken. And the sample of energy is then usually rectified right there on the spot with a diode that's usually in the sampling area. And then this DC signal is sent back to the transmitter for metering on the front of the transmitter with either an analog meter or with a turned into digital for a digital watt meter. And this is calibrated to show you the 100% power or how many watts or kilowatts of power that you're putting out. So the place to measure that most usually is at the end of the low-pass filter, because we're interested in how much signal are we sending out of the transmitter on our desired frequency and into the transmission line and up to the antenna. So, guys, maybe we should move on to the transmission line and the antenna, spend just the next 10 minutes on that before we finish up with our FM Foundation series. You know, the FM antenna is a little bit different than the AM antenna. A couple weeks ago, we talked about how the entire tower is the AM antenna. Well, the FM broadcast band is operating at a much higher frequency, typically, 100 times the frequency or 100 times shorter wavelength than the AM band typically. So we're talking about wavelengths of about 10 feet to 12 feet, about 2 meters or so. And so, I'm sorry, did I get that wrong or is it close?
No, you're right. You're right.
Okay. You're right.
Well, we have to get this signal up the tower. FM frequencies are they're pretty much line of sight. They'll bend around things a little bit, but they're pretty much line of sight. The idea is to get the antenna up as high as possible, so it covers the largest possible area, gets the most possible listeners that we can. So the antennas on the FM service, we get them up as high as possible within the limitations of the license and within the power limitations of the license as well. And to carry that signal up there, we use some coaxial cable. And most everybody's familiar with this. It's kind of like your cable TV coax, except it's a whole lot bigger. And there's a lot more copper in there. All of this occurs, the physical sizes of all this stuff is dictated and is dictated by the operating impedance that we want to operate at. It turns out that it's convenient for us to build a transmission line and to build antennas that have a characteristic operating impedance of about 50 ohms. And so that this has to do with the diameter of the inside conductor of the coax and the diameter of the outside conductor. And there's a relationship between these two. So if you have a smaller coax for carrying less power, then the relationship between the size of the inner conductor and the outer conductor will be such that it'll exhibit a 50-ohm characteristic impedance. But this holds true for going up to very large coaxes as well that can carry many hundreds of thousands of watts of RF power. So some typical sizes in the broadcast industry, we might use 1 5/8 coax. We might use 2 1/4 inch coax or 3 1/8 inch coax.
3 1/8, yeah.
Yeah, 3 1/8 is typical for higher powered stations. So the coax has some big brass connectors. It connects to the end of the directional coupler at the end of the low pass filter and takes this power up the tower to where the antenna is.
Another thing to mention too with that coax, it's usually air dielectric, which means you usually charge it with nitrogen or dehydrated air, and that's how you that's the dielectric in the larger lines instead of foam like you'd find in a cable TV. It's actually charged with air or nitrogen.
That's a good point. And I should point out that why do we even bother to pressurize the coax at all? And as Chris mentioned, we usually do this with nitrogen because it's convenient, it's not expensive, and that actually doesn't it increase the flashover point of the coax?
Yeah, it's actually less dense than oxygen.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's denser than oxygen. It's inert, and it can give you a much better coefficient for insulation between the center conductor and the outer. So you can avoid the flashover from an arc because of power spikes or antenna impedance change, cable getting nicked. You can usually, and with the pressurized cable, if you should suffer a breach in the seal of the cable itself, the transmission cable, it'll force out the contaminants or whatever the breach may have occurred, how it may have occurred, and prevent a shorting of the center conductor to the outside shield.
You know, I've had this question come up before. Hey, if the coax is sealed, then why do we need to pressurize? If it's sealed against moisture coming in, or anything, and moisture is a big killer for this whole process, if it's sealed, then why do we worry about this? Well, think about this. If there is one or more microscopic holes in the system or a tiny leak around an O-ring at one of the connectors, every day the sun comes up, it beats down on the black coax, it gets it warm, expansion the air inside control. The coax gets warm, and it finds its way out. Well, at night, the coax cools off again, and now the pressure is lower inside the coax, and so air from the outside wants to find its way in. What's it going to bring with it at night? It's going to bring some moisture in with it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So it does this over and over and over again, and before long, moisture builds up in the coax. It usually runs down the inside of the coax to the bottom. We usually put a drip loop in the bottom so water on the outside of the coax will drip off and not run into the building. But this is also where water collects that's inside the coax if we don't keep it pressurized. In fact, one of the emergency procedures that I've seen happen at several stations is the station management or the engineer will not pressurize the coax. They'll let it run out. There'll be a major leak somewhere, and they'll never find it. And so you'll come to the transmitter site and the station's not getting out very well, or the transmitter's complaining. You'll go grab the bottom of the drip loop of the coax outside the building, and it's hot. And you shake it, and it goes...
I had a station where that was the issue, and I put a hole, that tiny hole in the bottom where the loop was, and water just started pouring out. It was unbelievable. Oh,
yeah. I've done that a couple of times, and I would compare it to a horse with a full bladder.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, that was always the argument.
So much hot water would come out of the... So, guys, here's what happens. We take a drill, electric drill, turn the transmitter off, and drill a little hole up in the bottom of the coax, at the bottom of the drip loop, and just stand back and wait for the water to fly out. And this is what happens when there's poor maintenance done with the coax and the pressurization that ought to be in it. Yeah?
Yeah. That's why a lot of engineers, the guys I work with, the tutelage of being a young journeyman, that was the argument engineers would choose over nitrogen tanks or a dehydrator, which was a machine that would take the moisture out through various chemical rocks, take the moisture out of the air, and that would be used to pressurize the line so that in the event of a breach, connector failure, O-ring, somebody hits the cable while they're climbing it and causes a tear, at least the dehydrator would continue running, forcing out the air and keeping the water and moisture from getting in at night. And then, of course, hopefully you have an alarm that would go off to say, hey, the dehydrator has been running beyond the duty cycle. We've got a problem. To avoid that drip loop incident where you're spilling out water and hoping that the rest of the cable hasn't been totally destroyed internally from corrosion, and that creates resistance and issues for itself.
And once you've drilled that hole in the bottom of the coax, it's you can't just put some tape over it and seal it back up, because now there's going to be air, nitrogen, whatever, getting between the outer conductor of the copper and the inside of the jacket. So things will never, ever be right once you've had to get the water out by drilling a
hole. Although you never know. If the owner was cheap enough to let it get that way, he may just insist that you tape it up anyway.
So. Yes, exactly.
You never know.
I'm not saying it hadn't been done before. Another interesting product to keep a coax pressurized is a nitrogen generator. I believe the Amana company makes these. Have I seen those?
I've heard about them. I have not seen one.
I want to say it's Amana, or maybe I want to say it's some old division of Raytheon, but some company makes a device that actually extracts nitrogen from the atmospheric air and will keep your coax pressurized with that. Some people think that that's a better solution. It's certainly a more expensive one. but a better solution than the air dehydrators, which, as you mentioned, usually work by running the air through some chemical rocks and getting rid of the moisture that way. All right, let's take the antenna last now. So the antenna is up on the top of the tower, and these FM antennas take all different forms and formats. I'll put a couple links in the show notes so you can go to these websites and see different designs. But no matter how the antenna is designed, and oftentimes there's one company that makes some that look like rototiller tines. A company called ERI makes those. Another company called PSI makes some that look fairly similar. But there are a number of different designs from companies like Dielectric, Shively, ERI, SWR, PSI, who am I leaving out? I'm sure I'm leaving somebody.
Jampro,
yes, of course. Jampro makes some popular ones that look like a double arrowhead, like this.
The penetrator.
The penetrator, that's right. the whole idea of the FM antenna, though, is to translate this energy that's in the coax and being fed to the antenna and to put this as electromagnetic waves into the air, into the atmosphere, and launch those waves in all directions, kind of like a shape of a donut or a pie plate, but to launch this to the horizon where the listeners are. I'll mention a couple factors, and then you guys can chime in with your own experiences. Oftentimes, FM stations will have a multiple bay FM antenna, and that multi-bay FM antenna will have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, maybe 12 or more antennas, and they're all spaced the right distance apart, such that it's additive in what it's putting out onto the horizon. You know, when we're transmitting an FM signal, we don't need to transmit any signal up in the air. We really don't need to transmit any signal right down to the transmitter building. We'd rather take all that signal from up and down and squeeze it to the horizon where all the people are. And, of course, if it's tilted down a little bit, that's not so bad either. But we want to take all the energy from the transmitter and just lay it around the horizon, all around the tower, 360 degrees, unless we have a directional antenna when we want to point it one way more than another. So multiple bays have that effect. They stop the power from going up and down, and they concentrate the power out to the horizon. Typically a two-bay antenna, well, let's see, you know what, there's all kinds of ways to talk about this. We don't really have time to go into it so deeply. In fact, a future show will have an antenna expert or two on the show. Just suffice it to say that there's a couple ways to put this power out on the horizon. We can have something called horizontal polarization, like many TV stations are. We can have vertical polarization, like many two-way radios for, you know, police and fire, things like that are. Or we can also have something that is called circular polarization. Now, ideally, it would go out in the form of a corkscrew. I'm not really sure how you'd visualize it, but let's just say that there's energy in the horizontal, there's energy in the vertical, and hopefully there's energy all around. The idea is to take advantage of the fact that many FM radios are going to have a randomly polarized antenna. So if you're transmitting vertically, you want to receive with a vertically polarized antenna. If you're transmitting horizontally, you want a horizontally polarized antenna, as we've done with TV for many, many years. But if you have a random antenna, like you do with an FM receiver, maybe it's the power cord, who knows what you got. Maybe it's your headphone is your antenna. We want to try to put out power in all phases, all planes, if we can. And that's what circular polarized antennas for FM transmission typically will accomplish or try to accomplish. And so we typically have a gain of about 0.5 for every bay. And if we space them one wavelength apart, we get two bays, we have a gain of one, or about one. If we have three bays, we have a gain of 1.5. Four bays, we have a gain of two. Now, do we really, really have a gain? Well, no, we don't. We're not making power from nothing. It's not a perpetual motion machine. We're actually just taking power that would have gone straight up and straight down and squeezing it a bit toward the horizon. And that's how we get gain out of antenna. So we can put 20,000 watts into the bottom of an 8-bay antenna, and we can get roughly 8-bay or 10-bay? 10-bay antenna, and get roughly 100,000 watts of effective radiated power out to the horizon. And the whole point of this is to come up with two terms for you: TPO, transmitter power output, and ERP, effective radiated power. So when an FM station says, we're 100,000 watts, or we're 50,000 watts, or whatever it may be, that's not necessarily the power being put out by the transmitter. That's the effective power being put out by the antenna if it were, say, an ideal isotropic radiator, that is a point source radiator. So we're allowed to claim more power if it's the same amount of power that would have been put out by a single point source from that place. Is that a good enough answer? That's a lot of data, guys.
I want to answer a quick question that somebody posted on the IRC channel about vertical and horizontal polarization, too. Somebody mentioned that in addition to circular, they've seen some antennas that are horizontal, they're separate bays, horizontal and vertical. And one of the reasons they do that is you can actually have different power levels and different polarizations. And one of the reasons they do that in some areas, the FCC, I don't believe, allows it much anymore, but you can space stations closer together using different polarities. And you still see this in the non-com bands where you have stations that are vertical only or horizontal only. And the reason that you do that is because you can space the stations closer together because they won't interfere because the signals are horizontally and vertically polarized, so they don't interfere as much. So you still see some of that as opposed to just always seeing circular polarization. Sometimes you see vertical only or horizontal, or they do both, but they have different power levels on the different planes.
That's a very good point, and that's very true.
Mm-hmm. And they're they're using that technique on some of the HD stations now. We're in FM HD, and you're having an issue with spacing and working. They're actually trying that concept. I just read about it recently, so it's not too far out of the realm of seeing that still today. In Europe, they do a lot of that. A very popular vertical-only antennas you'll see all over Europe for FM.
Tom, did you have something?
No, what I was going to say is we could probably make another show out of this entirely because you'd mentioned before if somebody says, you know, they're a 50,000-watt station, it's not coming out of what's coming out of transmitter. It might also not be what's coming out of the antenna, depending on the height of average terrain. And like I said, we could make a whole other show talking about height above average terrain. Basically, a Class B station at 350 feet, you're allowed 50,000 watts. The higher the antenna, you have to bring your ERP down.
Right. Here's a tiny bit of inside baseball, guys. Do you think we could have Alex Perkovich and Tom Silliman on the same show?
We could try. I think Tom would be up for it. I don't know. I think they'd be up for it.
Yeah, right. Maybe Tom and Bob Surrett.
There you go. I'd like any of them on in any time, but I've been friends with Bob Surrett at Shively for many, many years. Guys, we're going to have to wrap this up, and I see we could do a whole show just on antenna theory. There's a lot of cool things to talk about with that. I think FM antenna and TV antenna theory is pretty fascinating. TV has so many different types of antenna that they get to use, like from bat wing antennas to slotted antennas and others that I'm not even sure about. But in FM, we typically use multi-bay circular polarized antennas, at least in the U.S. and in many other countries as well. So we've tried to take you, listeners and viewers, from the baseband signal through modulation, through amplification, and out the antenna. So much more that we could do. We'll, again, put show notes on there. If you're watching us live on the Twit Network, thank you very much for watching. We sure appreciate you tuning in. You're also welcome to subscribe to the podcast in the iTunes store. Just do a search for TWIRT, TWIRT, or This Week in Radio Tech. You'll find it there. We have a page on Facebook. If you want to friend us there, you can get the get links to the latest shows. And of course, you can also check out the RSS feed, which is on the homepage of the website at thisweekinradiotech.com. I want to thank the co-host for being here, Chris Tarr. Thanks for showing up. Sure appreciate it.
There we go. No problem. Anytime.
This is Tom Ray, and I brought my buddy Scrappy with me.
Hi, Tom Ray. Thanks for showing up. You too, Scrappy. Let's see. There's Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris Tobin. Thanks for showing up. Appreciate it.
Hey, welcome. Anytime.
And there's Chris Tarr. Thank you, buddy. We'll catch you guys next time on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another twirt has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Honex wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny Lopez Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission. Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango. Signing off. Okay.